Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Republican presidential field narrows after a dramatic New Hampshire primary. The Department of Justice sues Ferguson, Missouri, after the city amends a police reform deal. And the Supreme Court puts President Obama's climate regulations on hold. Here for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Neil King Jr. of The Wall Street Journal, Jackie Combs of The New York Times, and David Rennie of The Economist. Of course, we will be live video streaming the Friday News Roundup in this hour. You can go to WAMU.org, click on live, watch live. You can come to us by phone, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@WAMU.org. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook. And it's so good to see you all.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, Diane.
Hello.
Happy to have you all here. All right, your thoughts about last night's debate, Jackie?
Well, it was substantive and rather quiet until the second hour and got a little feisty there. And I especially enjoyed the split screens when you could see how Bernie Sanders there like a caged animal ready to attack.
But what were the issues that got him feisty? What made them angry? What got them really talking about substantive
issues? Well, it was a lot of the same issues they've talked about before, but I think they're of higher, almost higher imperative now that they're heading into South Carolina and Nevada, where you have an African-American constituency and a Hispanic constituency in Nevada, because, you know, for instance, the two biggest things that got Bernie Sanders riled up were when she, Hillary Clinton, was pointing out how he has attacked and criticized President Obama, which, of course, doesn't go over well with black Democrats. And she also pointed out that he had opposed a 2007 immigration bill that Ted Kennedy co-sponsored and she supported. And that, of course, resonates with Latino voters in Nevada.
This How do you feel about it, Neil?
It was in many ways the big embrace of Barack Obama by Hillary Clinton, who's had to pivot in various ways to find kind of where her place is going to be. And is she going to be kind of try to a little bit out progressive Bernie Sanders, or is she going to be the woman of experience who should be elected on the basis of her experience? And in this case, it was very clear that at least for now, she's going very much to, I'm going to run on the legacy of the Obama administration. I'm going to accuse Bernie Sanders of proposing totally unrealistic things. She's trying to puncture his, you know, he's all about Donald Trump is let's make America great again. Bernie Sanders is let's make America great for the first time. Let's have everything. And we don't quite know how we're going to pay for it, but we're going to have universal health care and so on. And she, I thought pretty effectively, actually, was like, Bernie, your numbers don't add up. Hmm. And was really going after him. And he, the one time when he said that was a low blow was when she was basically saying, you're acting like a Republican. You are attacking the president of the United States, our party's head, as somebody who's less and is weak and has not actually done the things that all of us Democrats are proud of.
David Rennie.
And I thought that was... It probably didn't really move the needle last night, and I suspect a lot of Sanders fans watching didn't like it. But I think you can see there the foundations of actually a quite a clever strategy for Hillary Clinton. Her core problem is that to win back some of those Sanders voters, ultimately she has to convince them that they are deluded about what is possible and that Bernie Sanders is selling fantasies that will not get through the Republican-dominated Congress that the next president will inevitably have. And so what she was essentially doing is, by clinging very, very much to Barack Obama's record, as Jackie and Liv said, she wasn't just wooing, you know, black voters who like Barack Obama. She was saying, we have the same strategy of incrementalism, taking half a loaf and hoping to get the full loaf later. And if you don't like that, if you think that we live in a kind of oligarchic dystopia which is ripe for a revolution, which is what Bernie Sanders' pitch is, then be very clear, you're also criticizing the way that Barack Obama has run this country for the last 8 years.
At one point, Hillary Clinton said, when I am president, and Bernie Sanders came in and said, you're not there, Secretary Clinton.
It didn't seem to go over all that well, just from what you heard in the office. There seemed to be some a little
which
bit of murmuring.
Didn't go over.
His comment that she, you're not there yet, Hillary. And he did. I mean, that was just one of the comments that Bernie Sanders had that sort of made clear that he has more confidence coming out, as he should, I suppose, coming out of New Hampshire where he walloped her. And he almost seemed like the front runner on the stage, and she was the one on defensive. I thought one of her best lines against him was that where she said, I'm not a single issue candidate. Although you have to ask, you know, and which I assume she's inferring, or that he's, it's all about, you know, the billionaire class and about money and the rigged economy. On the other hand, that resonates pretty well, just that single issue message with the people who like Bernie Sanders.
How important do you think these debates actually are, David Rennie, in terms of changing people's minds?
I think that we've seen just in the last few days. I mean, look at the Republican race in New Hampshire in the primary there. Marco Rubio had a terrible debate on the Saturday night just before the primaries. He was, you know, brutalized by Chris Christie. He sounded, you know, he repeated his talking points. It made him look wooden, and people said robotic. And then all of us reporters, I was in New Hampshire with the PAC, and we were saying, maybe this won't hurt him. Maybe we're over-imagining that this will hurt him. It really hurt him. It turned out to really, really hurt him because it did that deadly thing of crystallizing something that people already were uneasy about. And I think that in politics, you know, that's when things can change in a heartbeat. So that debate, ironically, the man who launched the attack, it was a suicide murder pact, as people are writing. You know, Chris Christie ended up dropping out of the campaign. But that was an example of these debates mattering because they show us kind of in real time what we're already wondering.
How well did Donald Trump do in New Hampshire?
Well, he had, you know, of course, just looking at the election results, he did quite well. And he did pretty much exactly as it's been foreseen for months in the polling. And it was interesting, like, because it was so clear, the victory on both sides, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, all the networks called the thing basically the minute the polls closed. And then the race on the Republican side immediately became, the only tension point was who's going to come in second or who's going to come in third, which is pretty interesting. We were talking about this before, but of the 16 New Hampshire primaries since 1952, when it became the first primary in the nation, 13 on the Republican side have been won by the person that then went on to become the nominee. I don't think that there's ever been a case where anyone who came in third in New Hampshire went on to become the nominee. And yet this was a case where there was this obsession about who's going to come in third. But on the other hand, the who came in third might actually matter, because that's what's so bizarre about this election we're in, where all the precedent is out the window.
So how much does experience matter to people?
You know, pretty much not at all. I had to laugh last night. One of the things I tweeted was that Bernie Sanders actually had the gall to talk about. He was like, of all the years I've been in Congress, and then he sort of said, like, you know, kind of suggested, like, and there have been a few. I've been around for a few. And I was like, wow, somebody actually noted their years in Congress. Like, why would any? And on the Republican side, the only person who's done anything remotely like that is John Kasich. And what he does is he talks about the years in Congress, like, which were now a pretty long time ago, and the things he did balancing the budget and other things. But otherwise, this is an experience of free election. Well, I should say Hillary Clinton, of course.
Yes,
her
great
main mantra is, I'm the person with the most experience and the best suited for this job.
But how strongly did John Kasich come out of New Hampshire?
Well, it's, you know, he kind of came out as sort of the story of the night, and yet he had 11% of the Republican vote. So, it was, you know, was it?
So I think it wasn't 16, 17. Yeah, anyway.
I went to bed. but he still, it was, you know, when less than one out of five of the Republican voters in New Hampshire, which was to be one of his best states, and his one of his main strategists, John Weaver, was, you know, an architect of John McCain's great campaigns there, where he walloped George W. Bush in 99-2000. It gave him life for another day. So now he goes on to South Carolina, which is not such a great state for him. So it's, you know.
The other thing, too, is Kasich had invested. I think he did 100 town hall meetings. He was all in on New Hampshire. So he put basically all his chips there. He did pretty well. As a result, he hasn't really invested all that much time in the states going forward.
Well, let's be clear. The reason that we're interested in who comes third, or even, you know, people were saying, oh, look, Jeb Bush came fourth. That's great for him. It's like, really? Why are we having this conversation? It's because we know that there is, among other things, there is a vast pool of big business friendly Republican kind of establishment people with a barrel full of money. And if they see someone who looks like they're capable of stopping Donald Trump and stopping Ted Cruz, two candidates who they suspect will lose them the general election, then they will take that barrel of money and they will pour it over the head of that champion. So there is a race,
sure,
the third and fourth place, to have that barrel of money poured over you. But the problem is there isn't a champion yet.
Yeah, haven't you already seen that money moving from one candidate to another?
Some.
A little bit, but I think most of it is still on the sidelines.
It's in the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
It's waiting.
It's in the barrel, yes. Waiting to see what comes next. All right. We are as well. When we come back, we'll talk about other issues and take your calls. Remember, you can watch this portion of the Friday News Roundup by going to drshow.org, watch video live, and stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back to the Domestic Hour of the Friday News Roundup, this week with Jackie Thompson, New York Times, David Rennie with The Economist, and Neil King of The Wall Street Journal. During the break, David Rennie, we were talking about the kerfuffle over the weekend, over the statements of two women, Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem. Go over what happened.
Well, it was a very sort of surreal moment because you had Gloria Steinem, the great feminist icon, saying something that was essentially sexist. She was talking about why so many women, particularly young women, are going to the Sanders campaign. And she said, well, maybe they're going where the boys are. And you know, it was an astonishing thing to say. She was rebuked immediately by the Clinton campaign. And Madeleine Albright, slightly less kind of egregious. She has a line that she's used for a long time, that women who don't support other women, there's a special place in hell reserved for them. And she used that line. But I think what they're both expressing is a real alarm on the Clinton side, that not only is she not winning among sort of all women, but there's a particular demographic that has been vital to the Democrats in the last couple of cycles, a real pillar of the Obama coalition, which is unmarried women. They went for President Obama in both his elections by gigantic margins. And they are going for Bernie Sanders at the moment.
So why? That's the issue. Why are these young women not interested in Hillary Clinton?
Well, to generalize, I'd say, and as the mother of two 20-something girls, both on an anecdotal basis and just generally, that, you know, it's a post-feminist generation, and they've never not known, you know, things like reproductive rights. Of course, those are under attack across the country in state after state right now. But and you know, as Hillary Clinton herself said last night in the debate, freedom of choice, including the choice of choosing a man over a woman. I just think it's younger women just don't have that sense that you know, we need to have a woman president right now because they think they'll see one in their lifetime, whereas people in their mother's generations think this may be the last chance I get to see a woman as president.
How about you, Neil?
You know, the Democrats have a very long tradition of going for the new out-of-nowhere thing. Barack Obama was like that. Bill Clinton was like that. I mean, the Democrats don't tend to go for anything resembling the next in line. And even though Bernie Sanders isn't exactly young, for a lot of young people, he came out of nowhere. And here was this really bizarre, kind of funny, sometimes grumpy, disheveled person who had this very utopian view of what the world could look like and that went to a lot of the issues that they care about. Oddly, a lot of them are things like health care and Social Security that most younger people don't really care about. But I think women are going for him in the same way that men are, that because they find him really fresh. I do think that Hillary Clinton has handled this whole thing pretty well. Last night, she was asked about this. And I thought, and she actually said with a smile, "I've worked my whole adult life to empower women to make their own choices, even if that choice is not to support me," which is a line she's sort of been using this week. And it was funny, actually.
Yeah.
And she's been sort of heartfelt about that.
But the question becomes, is she going to shake up her campaign operation in order to somehow recast?
Yeah, you know, that came out this week. I think Politico wrote about it. It made a bit of a kerfuffle. David Axelrod at one point had tweeted that this was sort of vintage Clintons to not look at the inward at themselves, but to look at their staff. And it is true, oddly enough, in the last go-around, well, I should say in 08 go-around, February 9th, they were taking a shellacking. They had just come out of the primaries in some distant states like Nebraska and Louisiana and caucuses and the like. And they had a staff shuffle then. That was February 9th. Of course, the calendar's different, so that was actually like a month ahead of where we are now. My prediction would be no staff shakeup of any kind now. If we come out of Super Tuesday on March 1st and Bernie Sanders has done really well in a bunch of states and they might have like fought to a draw, which is totally possible, that will be the big defining moment, I think, of this race in terms of where the nation is when it comes to Bernie Sanders, then we could see a lot of fear and loathing in the Clinton campaign, and we could see staff shake up.
But I think what must be so frustrating for people inside the Clinton campaign, in fact, I spoke yesterday to some people who'd been in the Clinton White House and who are kind of tearing their hair out about, you know, where we are right now, is it's not that the campaign has made a series of absolutely gigantic mistakes that we can all point to. And if you look at the exit polls in New Hampshire, among people who are registered Democrats, and among people whose top concern is electability, choosing someone who can win in November, she's doing just fine. I think the really confounding, frustrating, difficult thing for Clinton world is that so many people like Bernie Sanders because they don't seem to care about electability in the same way. It's not their top issue. Now, as a kind of rational, chilly kind of logic guy, I don't understand how electability isn't your top issue. Because if you lose, you lose. And I think that part of this is young people, and I'm going to sound like a grumpy 40-something here, a lot of millennials, a lot of 20-something Americans, they don't remember a Republican winning the White House in a landslide. They remember George Bush maybe squeaking it, if they can remember that. Or they don't even remember Bush. They just remember Obama winning twice. And they think, oh, you know, the country's getting less white and demographics are bringing it our way. I think that a lot of them are just really complacent. They think that the White House belongs to the Democrats. And that's why they're so willing to
Well, and the corollary of that is in our current times, the Congress essentially belongs to the Republicans, which, given the redistricting lines and the politics, the population shifts
to
the South.
It's hard to change that.
Yeah, it will be, you know, most people would tell you that it would be after 2020 before the Democrats would ever have a hope, if then, of taking back the House of Representatives. Why is this important? Well, you know, the millennials don't also remember maybe the 2007-2008 campaign very well. When Barack Obama was the candidate of hope and change, much has changed. You know, just ask Marco Rubio whether things have changed under Obama, and he'll tell you four times that they have. But the fact is that one of the biggest raps against Barack Obama is that he hasn't been able to do what he promised, and that is bring the city together, bring the capital together, and get big things done in a bipartisan way. Which makes you question, how in the world is Bernie Sanders going to do that? But millennials, you know, have to sort of look at beyond the White House. You also have to look at what kind of Congress would President Sanders face.
And what kind of Supreme Court you would have under a Republican president.
Well, that's always one of these issues that sort of lingers out there, and I think it's really one of the most important ones for both sides, that what is the estimate now that the next president will probably pick
four?
Okay, I was going to say three. Of course, we don't really know.
Yeah.
But it will be a very big thing. And as we were reminded of this week, the Supreme Court is a hugely important out of nowhere. In this case, the decision on the emission standards was like a really out of nowhere move on their part. They can be a really decisive factor. And I think that for Hillary Clinton in particular, I think that will be one of the things that she will, and already has, hit on quite a lot.
Talk about that Supreme Court decision and the environment.
This was really an important and very strange and unprecedented move on the part of the Supreme Court, my understanding. So just to step back a little bit, as very much a part of his greenhouse gas initiative and the whole climate change push that came to a head in Paris at the end of last year, the whole global agreement, was the U.S. commitment that they will cut greenhouse emissions state by state by about a third by 2030. And it's based very much on going to the states and saying, you must figure out your own path forward to make these reductions, and you must come back to us with your plans by 2018, or you can even get an extension. A bunch of states, mainly red states, 20-something of them, sued. And in the normal process, this would go through the appellate levels, and then the Supreme Court would weigh in on some appellate decision, pro or con. My understanding is that on Friday, they got all the brief books, and they decided just like that, in a very unexplained, strange decision, 5-4, that, nope, they're going to put a stay to the whole thing, and has thrown a wrench into, anyway, what is a very important for the administration, global emissions climate change agreement. And
where
it's uncertain.
Where does that leave the United States vis-a-vis the rest of the world on this agreement?
It kicks the whole thing out from under them right now.
I mean, just preparing for this program, I went and looked at some of the French newspapers last night. They were covering this because, this, as Neil says, this was the court not striking down an Obama administration policy. What they did was they said, all of these lawsuits from 27 states and from some big power companies, this is about a policy about how you generate electricity. This is the Clean Power Plan. And what the court essentially said is, we think that quite possibly the president has overstepped his bounds, because the president has very large authority over how the federal government operates. But the argument here, and there may be some legal argument here to this, is this: essentially, the federal government can change how the federal government does its business, but it's too much for the president to say, here's a new rule at the federal level, which then makes gigantic changes in the states and will make the states and the power industry and all these large companies take multi-billion dollar decisions just to keep up with this federal rule change. And I think what they said is that there's a reasonable argument that he's overstepped his bounds, that Congress really is the only body that can make this kind of degree of a change. But this is not going to happen in Obama's term. And so that's what you saw the European papers saying is, oh, my goodness, the next president is going to decide this question. And then if it's a Republican, they know what that means. It's
all right.
Not going to happen.
Going back to the Hillary question and young women, we have an email from Carol Ann who says, young women are supporting Bernie because Hillary Clinton has a credibility integrity problem.
Well, that is one thing that we've seen very distinctly in the exit polls coming out of both Iowa and New Hampshire. When asked about, is honesty and integrity an important issue for you, for the people that say that it is, those people go substantially to Bernie Sanders. I mean, this is something that Hillary Clinton has wrestled with for a long time. It's very clearly something that is moving votes, particularly among, well, not just young people, into the Bernie Sanders camp.
All right. And here's a caller in Jupiter, Florida. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane, for taking my call.
Sure.
My question today is, why aren't more men and their voices being heard in support of Hillary Clinton? Why I say, I'm 64 years old. As long as I've lived on this planet, men have ruled the United States. Their voices have been heard over and above all women. I'm raising three daughters who I want to have a better life as a woman. In 2013, one out of every five women have been raped in this country. Under wages, inability to get better jobs, because of sexism. I want to see a better life for my daughter, and I know by putting Hillary Clinton in the White House, we can build and create a foundation, a beginning for all women's voices to be heard from now until whenever.
All right, Michael, thanks for your call. Here's a different point of view from Haley in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I feel like your panelists, like the Clinton group, they are pretty out of touch with my generation. I'm a millennial, and we appreciate the efforts that the baby boomer feminists made. Remember, though, that we're a really well-educated generation, and we aren't riding on gender as our key issue. We want someone who is the best candidate, who represents us all, and we are looking at the bigger picture.
So for you, Haley, what does the bigger picture mean?
Well, we look at the history books and we see that the American economy did best when we had a thriving middle class, when people were making livable wages. And our generation has not seen that at all. We would love a chance to have what the baby boomers had.
All right. Thanks for your call. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I know you want to respond, Jackie.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, that's what I was trying to say, is that her generation, millennial women, and like my daughters, have, you know, feel like they have the freedom to choose the candidate they want, whether it's a male or female, and that as much as they'd like to see a woman as president, it'll happen in their lifetime. The conditions in this country are such they don't see a barrier to a woman being president.
Of the things that Haley said, I thought the most powerful was the part at the end, which is fascinating, which is a kind of nostalgia, even among younger people that might not remember this moment, which if you look on the Republican side, these campaigns are built almost entirely around the concept of returning to something that we once had and once were, which was largely something in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where the country had incredible GDP growth, and we built the highway system, and we went to the moon, and all these things happened. And the country is a very different country now. We're much older. We have a much bigger Social Security state that we have to pay for. The finances don't work out as well. There's a lot of, and the economy has this mysterious weakness about it that we're trying to grapple to understand. And her point is an interesting one, which also there's a funny thing about Bernie Sanders, where on the one hand, he's not really looking back except for what his tax rates would be, right, which would be kind of like 60s and 70 era high tax rates, which he would need to pay for. But obviously, Haley sees in Bernie Sanders a sort of a nostalgia and a desire to return to a type of economy that we once had.
David.
Well, I think that, you know, I take the point absolutely that, you know, people are very angry about the fact that they've gone to college, they've got all this college debt and their jobs aren't there and the baby boomers, you know, are living in these expensive houses that young people can't afford. But here's the problem. I disagree certainly that we in this panel are kind of the Hillary campaign. I think what I'm saying and what The Economist magazine is saying is you have every right to be resentful about your current situation, but you have to fix it in the world that exists. You have to have policy ideas that will get through this Congress, the Congress that the next president is going to have to deal with. Our concern about Bernie Sanders is, one, his numbers don't add up. I mean, he's, you know, there's gigantic trillion-dollar holes in his budgets. And two, this is still a country with an awful lot of Republicans in it, and a Congress which is, as Jackie says, at least the House is going to be Republican, and Democrats are not going to have 60 seats, anywhere near 60 seats in the Senate. So the next president, whether it's Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, or Ted Cruz, is going to have to deal with that reality. And Bernie Sanders just is peddling dreams, and that's the problem.
Well, that is also the question. Are people simply responding to the person, the personality, the expectation of what that person might be able to do, rather than thinking about what can this person really accomplish, especially if the Congress is of a different party? I mean, are we as an electorate really thinking realistically?
Well, the short answer is no. And in fairness to voters, you know, you like to be idealistic. You like to
be
hopeful, and you don't want to take that away from people. But, you know, just as unrealistic as Bernie Sanders' platform is, given the government he'll face, you know, it's just as unrealistic Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. And I might throw in some of the other candidates, too. But it is, you know, voters do have to be more realistic without losing their idealism.
Jackie Combs of The New York Times, David Rennie at The Economist, Neil King at The Wall Street Journal. More of your questions, comments, and the president on political divisions in this country. Stay with us. And welcome back. Let's talk about the fact that the Department of Justice wants to sue Ferguson, Missouri. Tell us what that's all about, Neil.
Well, of course, it goes back to the August 2014 Michael Brown shooting and all the results that came out of that and the sudden focus on Ferguson, Missouri as being kind of the epitome of this small town that had a real problem in its policing and in the way that its court system operated. So the Department of Justice came in, intervened essentially in the affairs of Ferguson to kind of create a scenario, a plan that would remedy these things. And they were very close to having gotten an agreement that was very complicated in terms of body cameras for the police and how the courts would operate differently and various good practices that the police force would use. And in the end, in a vote this week, the city council voted for an amended plan, essentially, that had some things that were left out of what the DOJ wanted. And that in itself forced the hand of the Department of Justice, at least look they on their own terms it did, and they sued Ferguson on a bunch of counts, basically constitutional amendment grounds, First, Fourth, and 14th Amendment, basically pointing to what they were describing, some of these things being known before, that there was a practice, a history of all kinds of unfair practices that were largely race-based on harassing people, not giving them their due process when it came to the court side. The argument, which was interesting on the council side, is that this is a majority black city council. They voted 6-0 for the plan that the Department of Justice then didn't like, was a budget thing. They were basically saying what the Department of Justice is asking us to do would cost something like $14.5 million over 3 years, or no, I think it was $10 million, and they have a $14 million a year budget. So that would be a huge hit to them. Here we stand now with the huge Department of Justice going after a fairly small town in Missouri over their policing practices.
And in the meantime, have things in Ferguson improved?
They've improved certainly to the extent that we're not seeing the things that gave rise to this in the first place. And I think there are already a number of these practices that have been discussed with the Department of Justice are things that are making their way through the system.
And David Rennie, Janet Yellen testified before Congress this week about the U.S. economy. She was asked whether perhaps she had made a mistake by raising the interest rate even as little as she did.
That's right. And she was getting it from right and left.
Yeah.
Because Republicans tend to think that this is easy money, that it's all going to overheat, that we're going to see hyperinflation, this is outrageous stimulus to the economy. The markets, and probably most Democrats, were sort of maybe suggesting she should cut rates, that we should look about negative interest rates, as you're seeing in some countries now. And she said that she wouldn't take negative interest rates off the table. I think the market's expectations are now that there may not be a whole bunch of rate rises, even small rate rises, this year. And what this is really about is, you know, America has been doing a bit better than certainly other large economies, certainly compared to Europe and some, you know, China's slight slowdown. So America had been a bit of a beacon of hope. She's basically saying it's fragile. She's concerned. She's concerned about inflation being too low. That sounds like an odd thing, but actually very low inflation and deflation can be very, very dangerous for an economy, because if you think that TV is going to be cheaper next month, you don't buy it this month in crude terms. And so everyone stops spending. It's just bad for an economy. People's debts don't get eaten away by inflation. So she's in a pickle. It's an interesting thing. She has an interesting line, though. She says, we don't believe that recovery is die of old age. So she doesn't believe that it's kind of She thinks that something has to actually go wrong in the economy for the economy to turn down. She thinks if there's going to be a recession, you have to be able to show that something is actively going wrong. She doesn't believe that this kind of just runs out of puff and out of steam and that America
would
drift to a halt.
So she would not go so far as to say, I believe the economy will improve.
No, so in December when they made the first rate rise, tiny, tiny rate rise, remember, in December, first rate rise for a decade, that was kind of taking the patient out of the intensive care ward,
right,
putting them back in the general ward and saying, okay, you had your heart attack, now you're in a bit of better shape, we can put you in the general ward. And everything was looking pretty optimistic. She admitted in her testimony to Congress over 2 days, there's a whole bunch of alarming indicators, the slowdown in China, the low oil prices, which are good for some things but actually bad for others. There's just a lot of headwinds. And, you know, that patient is not running around a running track. They're still in a hospital bed. They're just not hooked up to life support.
You know, traditionally, Fed chairmen have one main piece of ammunition, which is the interest rate. And they generally raise and lower it to try to make various changes to the inflation rate and the job picture and so on. This is a Fed chairman and the one before her who has had none of that because the rates have been at zero for so long. So all that Janet Yellen really wants to do is to see an economy that's strong enough to bear her incrementally raising the interest rates. So if this recovery dies of old age or whatever it will die of, and it will at one point go down, she will have some traditional leverage to combat it, which is lowering rates. At the moment, we're already, even though the recovery is continuing and the retail numbers came out today, and they were strong, and we've seen these strong job numbers, there's already talk of the possibility of having to go into negative rates because we're basically flying at like 15 feet above ground. And that would be a really scary, strange moment. And though it has been underway in a number of other places, most recently in Japan, its track record of actually boosting growth is pretty meager so far.
And talk about scary moments. Think about stock market in this. Right. Last couple of weeks.
Right, and the stock market reflecting the global headwinds. And we've seen throughout this recovery, and one of the reasons it's been so slow since the 2008 and 2009 recession, is that every time the U.S. seemed to be, seeing the green shoots, there would be some, European debt crisis or something that sort of stopped it in its tracks. The other thing that Janet Yellen's Fed has working against it, as she knows and now takes for granted, but it's only been in recent years that this was so true, is that given the polarization in Congress, the Fed manages monetary policy. The other big tool that the government typically has is fiscal policy to stimulate an economy. But this is in a polarized Congress and White House, there is not, the Fed cannot count on them to provide stimulus to the extent they can. And there's now a sense, there's a consensus in the Fed and elsewhere, that interest rates will remain low, essentially, for a long time, that the trend has changed. And with that low interest rates, Congress and the White House should be providing more money by way of things like infrastructure,
exactly,
and long-term investments,
exactly,
education, and that would be something that would provide for long-term growth. But that isn't happening to the extent that Janet Yellen would like it to.
But the question becomes why? Why is the Congress so absolutely dead set against providing money for an infrastructure that is so terribly in need of it right now, and that would do exactly as Janet Yellen says. It would stimulate the economy.
And
is it totally political?
It is, and what's interesting is that, in general, business tends to favor Republicans over Democrats. But this is one of the few issues in which if you talk to big business leaders, they're really cross with the Republicans. There are a bunch of big CEOs who worry a huge amount about the state of people's roads and bridges and railway lines and air traffic control and dredging ports to take the new big ships that are going to come through the new big Panama Canal. I mean, any big business leader in this country can give you, a list of 10 infrastructure things that they would like to see money spent on right now to make sure that America is competitive. And they're in despair about the Republicans, as are quite a lot of Republican senators. If you talk to them in private, they would love to do some stuff on infrastructure.
So who's holding
the House? It's
back.
The House of Representatives.
Yeah,
and who within the House has the wherewithal to move this forward if it were not that Barack Obama is in the White House?
It's hard to see it moving necessarily under the current circumstances. The one thing I think could make something important move is if they were to cut some kind of bigger corporate tax deal. There's right. a push. A lot of people are still saying that's the one thing that might happen this year, where there would be a sort of one-off repatriation move. There's trillions of dollars of U.S. corporate profits overseas that are just sitting in Ireland and various places. If they would say, okay, your one-time reduced tax rate is going to be this, you bring it back, and this would be you know, tens and tens of billions of dollars that could be spent on infrastructure. That's the idea. You know, President Obama has been pushing in his budget that he's put forward, which isn't going to go anywhere, really. He put this $10 a barrel tax on barrel of oil, which is a roundabout attempt to basically do what nobody's been willing to do in Congress, which is to raise the gas tax, which has been sitting at the same level for decades, which has been the traditional means that we've raised money to spend on
highways. So I want to go back to my question. Is this all to ensure that the President of the United States does not get to be a success?
Well, you could find Republicans who would say that in their private moments or might even say it publicly. But at bottom, this just goes against the fundamental Republican creed. And there was talk late last year. Paul Ryan was in negotiations with the likes of Democrat Chuck Schumer and with the White House people about a package that, as similar to what Neil has referred to, would have used a sort of one-term infusion of tax money from multinational corporations to fund hundreds of billions in infrastructure. But they never got to the gory details because it was the Democrats wanted more spending than Paul Ryan and the Republicans were willing to support. And so I think we've lost the chance for another year. And In any case, always going to come down to the fundamental. Republicans are against raising taxes.
And the view of the federal government, the role of the federal government, it's not just about 2016 calculation. I mean, that's your question, I think. Is this just designed to kind of kneecap this president?
Well, but it's also about Barack Obama.
Infrastructure, you know, every single issue from infrastructure to what we feed kids in schools goes into the kind of mincing machine of partisanship now. And roads and bridges have gone into that. A lot of Republicans sincerely believe the federal government has no business. You know, Eisenhower would now be a dangerous communist for building his highways. This has to be done by the states. It's up to the states to do this stuff. They also deeply dislike the idea of using federal highway funds to do things like public transport, because quite a lot of House Republicans don't think public transport is something you should do at all.
They're from the South and the West. They don't have a lot of
public. They don't believe in things like trains. You know, trains are socialist European things. You know, they're not to be built.
You know, it's so interesting. I've got Henry Petrosky coming on Monday. He is not only an historian of how things work, but one of his arguments is that without this infusion of money for infrastructure, the U.S. economy falters. Do Republicans want to see the U.S. economy falter? I mean, we're in a kind of catch-22 here that talks about what Republicans believe in, what Democrats believe in. But the fact of the matter is the country needs infrastructure.
The country needs a lot of those things. Like, to go to David's point, we're at a kind of crisis in the terms of our view of the federal government's role.
Exactly.
And with just profound differences over whether the federal government should be sort of the preeminent force on all of these things.
Neil King of the Wall Street Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Hillsborough, New Hampshire. Marco, you're on the air.
Hi there, Diane. It's great to have you back.
Thank you.
You sure will be missed. My question today is, considering the worst happens and Trump wins the presidency, can we consider him when we have to take care of international diplomacy?
Foreign affairs. And Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, you know, Donald Trump has a long legacy now, at least so far in this campaign, of saying that he knows a lot of everybody that makes up every nationality, and all those people are great people, and he gets along with the Chinese really well and the Mexicans really well. and has also said, on the other hand, a lot of things that are likely to make his presidency, should there be one, difficult with all of those nations. I think it's fair to say that we don't really know a lot about what his foreign policy would amount to, other than it would be really muscular, really strong, and would help make America great again. But it would be highly unpredictable, I think I could say that.
We've seen him make some extraordinary claims. I mean, I interviewed Donald Trump a while ago for a cover story, and I asked him about the South China Sea. You know, so, you know, what would you do if the Chinese keep building these airfields on these islands in the South China Sea? He goes, you know, Japan will take care of that. And I was like, well, what if Japan doesn't take care of that? And he goes, you know, Japan used to beat China all the time in wars. They can, you know, they can handle that. Then the other day on North Korea and the dictator Kim Jong-un, he said, you know, maybe the Chinese can make him disappear. I'll get the Chinese to make him disappear. So he's volunteering to make the communist government in Beijing assassinate one of their close allies. That's one of his more recent suggestions.
I mean, it just leaves you wondering, not so much where his comments come from, but the enormity of the population that believes what he says.
I can tell you, as a Brit living in America, looking at the British newspapers, the European newspapers, if you think that Europe was horrified by some of George W. Bush's policies, the coverage of this election in the outside world is just people have their heads in their hands in disbelief.
And yet, I gather the Parliament in England voted down the idea of excluding Donald Trump from England.
Yeah, that was right. That would have been ridiculous if we'd excluded him. I think we can cope with Donald Trump. We're brave enough for that.
Do you think the U.S. is ready for a Donald Trump?
I might challenge a little bit the idea, at least so far, that there's an enormity of support, that, as you said, for Donald Trump. If you look at, so at the moment he's getting about a third of the Republican vote. The Republican vote is itself maybe 40% or a third or so.
Yeah,
so we're talking about a third of a third, or maybe even a third of 40%. But we're still talking about the people that are really in love with Donald Trump are maybe 18% of the country, probably more like 15%. The whole key with him is this going to sort of shift as others drop out, and will he kind of catch a real, will he start to snowball in ways that will make him a de facto nominee within a month or so or a couple of months, and will that then swell into something that could imperil whoever the Democrat is? And it's extremely hard to predict.
Those are the questions we leave you with. We didn't answer too many this morning. We raised absolutely Neil King, The Wall Street Journal, Jackie Combs, and New York Times, David Rennie. He is Washington Bureau Chief and columnist at The Economist. Thank you all. Have a great weekend.
You too, Diane.
You too, Diane.
Peaceful.
Stay warm.
Peaceful. Yes. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Botee, Susan Casey, Danielle Knight, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Alex Drewinskis. Danielle Brown answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.